majority still of people who can make a difference in this country in affecting American policy towards Palestine, the vast majority of the people are still holding on to the myth that we will try to debunk and challenge today. You can see that the mythologies that informed the conversation in this country about the future of Israel in Palestine is still the very same conversation, as if the last 9 or 10 months have taught these people nothing about what is wrong with their attitude and their analysis.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on myths of Israel. A myth is a story passed down through generations that attempts to explain the origins of something. The foundational myth of Israel is a land without people for a people without a land. That myth had profound consequences that reverberate today. There were people there, the Palestinians. Such myths are characteristic of settler colonial societies such as South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. Sure, there were a few primitive savages, but they had to give way to superior beings. John Kennedy famously said, quote, "We stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West." Kennedy did not mention the great indigenous nations that were slaughtered by the colonizers. We must deconstruct the myths and reveal the realities behind them. Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa and was chair of the Tuma Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies in Haifa. Currently, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Gaza in Crisis, 10 Myths About Israel, and Lobbying for Zionism. During the course of his presentation, he mentions that he was detained and questioned for 2 hours by federal agents at the Detroit airport when he came to the United States. He was asked before being released about his views on Hamas, Gaza, genocide, and Israel. He spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. And now, Ilan Pape, Myths of Israel.
Thank you all for being here. It feels a bit surreal to talk about history at a time when we are all gathered here to think together how to stop the genocide in Gaza and the one that is developing in the West Bank, and how to strategize or help to strategize for the liberation of Palestine. But as I think many of you are aware, the history of the Zionist project in Palestine is a very important entry point for understanding the situation today and for discussing the future. And once we are thinking of extending the network of support for Palestine beyond our usual suspects, beyond the people we have worked for so many years together in the solidarity movement, we still, I'm sure, are aware about the level of ignorance and misinformation and mythologies that are connected to the way the mainstream media in this country and in the global north in general reports the history of Palestine, the situation in Palestine, and as well as in some very important academic centers, still in courses and modules across the academia in the global north, still the way the history is being told plays an important role in the immunity that Israel is granted by the Global North, and particularly by the United States, for its criminal policies on the ground. And it's not enough to defy or even defeat the misinformation and fabrication that goes along with the historical narrative that are being spent in, by the media or by the academia by soundbites. The machinery that produces these misinformed, misguided, and fabricated narratives is a very sophisticated one and includes a lot of important academics and journalists and wordsmiths, people who know how to write and how to talk and how to preach. In order to challenge them successfully, we need to understand the history of the place of the Zionist movement, of the Zionist project, in a profound way, through proper research, through professional historiography, and with the help of those who decided to devote their life for that kind of research and activity. So I think that their interaction, which was always very important in the left, between academics or intellectuals, educators, and activists, is something which is highly important for the success of expanding the network of solidarity with Palestine and contributing, be it a modest contribution, to the liberation of Palestine and the decolonization of historical Palestine. The 10 Myths of Israel, the book itself, was actually born out of this rather frustrating engagement I had, not with people in the solidarity movement with Palestine, but whenever I tried to expand my dialogue beyond those who are committed or have been committed strongly to Palestine. Whenever you try to expand the network, to try and say, I will talk with some people who seem to be reasonable, educated, have a modicum of decency in them, whose positions on other social and political issues you respect. In fact, some of them are your mentors in certain areas of study or human activity. You encounter this very solid narrative of why there is a conflict in Palestine, what is its origins, why is it continuing, and what is the best way to deal with it. And you understand that even if you had 50 minutes to talk with these people, if they would be patient enough to listen to you, even that would not be enough. That actually only if you can somehow convince them to sit in your class for a whole year, as I suggested the two agents of the Homeland Security in Detroit when they kept teaching me the history of Palestine. I thought that only a year with them, I mean, with these two guys, I probably needed 2 years. You really need a year at least to unpack and challenge the kind of history that maybe for some of you would sound bizarre, but the vast majority still of people who can make a difference in this country in affecting American policy towards Palestine are still holding on to the myth that we will try to debunk and challenge. We can divide these mythologies or myths to ones that come from the past, even the distant past, some that are still with us and relate to a more kind of contemporary issues, or the present if you want, and some that are associated with the way people who are in a position to influence policies are talking about the future. And some of these myth about how to engage in a conversation about the future of Palestine have unfortunately emerged in the last year, put forward by the professional side of the Biden administration, and they come under the title of the day after. And the day after, the way it is being articulated not just by the politicians, by the president, the vice president, or the secretary of state, but if you read more into the kind of more professional policy papers that have been prepared under the title of the day after, mainly for Gaza, but not only for Gaza, for the whole issue of Palestine, you can see that the mythologies that informed the conversation in this country about the future of Israel in Palestine is still the very same conversation, as if the last 9 or 10 months have taught these people nothing about what is wrong with their attitude and their analysis. So the first, probably, and you're familiar, a myth that for many of us would sound maybe ridiculous or obnoxious or unrealistic or untrue or invalid, is still one that you can hear a lot of people repeating in one version or the other. And that's the myth that Palestine was a land without people, waiting for the people without land. And what is important in challenging the first part of this myth, that Palestine was a land without people, is that you don't do it by saying, no, it was. Thank God, for the last 20 or 25 years, very erudite, industrious historians have managed to reconstruct for us the history of Palestine on the eve of the Zionist arrival. And Palestine before the arrival of the Zionists, the early Zionists arrived in Palestine in 1882. Palestine on the eve of the arrival of the Zionists was a place with a vibrant society where people were mostly living in rural areas, but also had an urban centers, some urban centers, which were were organically connected to the rest of the region, which in Arabic was called the Mashrik, that is the Eastern Mediterranean. And the flow of ideas, of culture production, of ideas and platforms included very much Jaffa and Haifa and Jerusalem, as it did Beirut, Damascus, Alexandria, or Cairo. All these cities were interconnected organically in cultural, economic, and social ties. And that's why Palestine was such a vibrant place. The period, and I think some of you know that, in the history of that part of the world, the period that precedes the arrival of the Zionists, namely more or less 1800, to 1882, is called the period of the Renaissance, al-Nahda in Arabic. The Renaissance of which meant, as in anywhere else in the world, when we talk about Renaissance, that is where new ideas are flowing, where people are producing through plays, through fiction, through journalism, and any other kind of cultural media, new works, new interpretation of the reality, and in that particular age, the age of nationalism, it also helps to gel a collective identity receiving new ideas such as self-determination, liberation, and independence as part of the overall perception of who you are, where you came from, and where you're going. And this society was on the way, like the other societies around it, on the way towards a challenge period where European imperialism began to replace the Ottoman Empire that ruled that area for 400 years. But with European imperialism came also the good contributions of Europe to that area, as well as the more negative ones. And it's very, very clear, although we are not allowed to write a book in history which says what would have happened if, we always tell our students, don't do that, But actually, we should tell our students to do that because it's very good for one's imagination and understanding alternative developments in history. But it's very clear that without Zionism, there's no reason to believe that Palestine would have not developed like the countries around it, with the same problems and same achievements. And maybe we always like to believe, maybe it would have done even better than its neighbors, given what we think, and I'm totally subjective here, about the quality of the people who lived between the river and the sea on the eve of the arrival of the Zionists. But definitely, this was not an empty land in terms of society, culture, and society, and people. And it's important to stress this point, because I think for quite a lot of liberals around the world, this idea that actually the Jews colonized, or a group of Jews colonized an empty place, makes it easier to defeat any notions that would equate Zionism with colonialism. Because if you colonize an empty space, then it's not really colonialism, just the movement into an empty land. But it was not. And as we know, many settler colonial movements treated lands with indigenous people as empty land. The Zionists have not invented anything new. In fact, they were inspired by those who already preceded them with the same notion that where you have indigenous people, the land is empty. The fact that, for example, it's Oxford University Press, still produces an atlas of the Arab-Israeli conflict by Martin Gilbert, in I think it's the 15th edition or something like that. And it has a cartographic history of Palestine, namely the history of Palestine through maps. And the first map is, of course, Palestine in the biblical times. And then you have Palestine during the Roman times. And then nothing really happens in Palestine until the Crusaders come. And between the Crusaders and the arrival of Zionism, again, there's a black hole. Nothing happened. And this is one of the most important tools for teaching, especially young people, the history of Palestine, a space that was not a place, a space where nothing happened until the Zionists arrived. And again, comparable to the way some atlases are telling the history of Australia, Americas, and so on. As for the myths of the Zionist movement representing people without land, well, this notion that people of the Jewish faith were a nation and therefore entitled to a nation state, and that nation state had to be the ancient biblical land of Palestine, has been also contested very successfully by professional historians. There is no doubt that there were Jews in the late 19th century who decided to redefine Judaism as nationalism. That's an historical fact. But that doesn't mean that this is something that, A, most of the Jews at the time accepted. In fact, not. It was a minority position. And it was transformed into a powerful movement, not because a lot of Jews were recruited behind the idea that Judaism is actually not a religion, but nationalism. They were recruited actually by two groups, I would say, who were, I call them selective anti-Semites, and I'll explain what I mean by that. One group, which is still very important today in sustaining Zionist mythologies, are the Christian fundamentalists, a very important stream in evangelical Christianity that long before any Jew thought about Zionism were already the early Zionists, dating back to the 17th century and 18th century. Why do I call them selective anti-Semites? Because they developed a dogma, which I think some of you are familiar with, the restorationist dogma, which believes that the Jews, the return of the Jews, so to speak, to the Holy Land, namely to Palestine, would precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and the beginning of the 1,000 years of Christ's rule on the globe. Now, why was it selective anti-Semitic? Because, in a way, what motivated the less pious members of this movement, what really attracted them to the idea, was that was a way, if you want, an elegant way of getting rid of the Jews and getting back the only Jew you really wanted, Jesus Christ. That's a double bill for a fanatic Christian fundamentalist. Couldn't be better. And they were very, very active on both sides of the Atlantic in pushing Jewish intellectuals to stand behind the idea that not only Judaism is nationalism, but it had to be fulfilled in Palestine. Even the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was not entirely sure that Palestine was the only possible destination for modernizing the Jews as a nation in state of a faith. He was willing to consider Uganda, for instance, when the British offered that, and some of his colleagues were even touring places here in the United States and in South America, in Azerbaijan, looking for places where maybe Zionism could be fulfilled. But in order to make sure that the new Jewish movement does not give up on the idea of Palestine as an exclusive destination for implementing Zionism as nationalism, the Christian Zionists were very important in pressuring the Zionist movement not to change course and to hone on Palestine as the main destination. And these Christian Zionists were holding important political, economic, and cultural positions on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, another myth that, of course, is immediately connected with this and is very relevant to our day is to equate Zionism with Judaism and therefore equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And I think many of you were accused in your time being anti-Semites because you declared yourself to be anti-Zionist, or if you are Jews yourself, or being self-hating Jew. Again, the problem with challenging this kind of equation is that you need some space and some patience of your interlocutors to understand that this is the wrong equation, that Judaism is religion and Zionism is ideology, and there are a lot of Jews who are not Zionists, and there are quite a lot of non-Jews who are Zionists, which shows you that this is an ideology that is beyond one religion or the other. But you will have to recount the history of the Zionist movement, how it becomes, how it transformed from a very marginal idea into a more powerful force. And it doesn't happen by itself. There is a very strong lobby that makes sure that Zionism becomes more and more equated with Judaism. You need a strong lobby and you need a very devoted advocacy, because for many people this does not sound very reasonable and valid. At the heart of all of this is something that I think quite a lot of people ignore in history. And that is the fact that the leaders of what is called Anglo-Zionism or American Zionism, that is the leader of Jewish communities who devoted their energy for the sake of Zionism, have never themselves thought of emigrating to Palestine. And if you look at the way the American Zionist movement developed, you can see that at the kind of a more hidden level of motivation was the fear that without Palestine there would be an influx of poor Jews from Russia into the United States. And that's one of the main reasons that some American Jews supported Zionism. Of course, they didn't say it aloud because that was not a very nice thing to say for supporting the colonization of Palestine. They support the colonization of Palestine because it was the homeland of the Jewish people. But not in America. There was, of course, another problem, that if Judaism is nationalism, there was always the danger of being accused of dual loyalty as well. So Jewish nationalism was fine for people in Romania, in Russia, but not for Jews in America. Because if Jews in America would say that their nationality is Jewish, then they are open to accusation of dual loyalty. And the same is true about British Jews and French Jews and so on. So this is a complex relationship that shows you that Zionism, more than anything else, contributed to anti-Semitism rather than being the panacea for anti-Semitism. And anything that happened in the last year or two just proves the point that this is what its main effect is on the relationship of the Jewish communities in the world with each other and with the other societies. Now, if we move closer to our time and we want to debunk mythologies that are still at the heart of the way mainstream media, mainstream politics, and mainstream academia in this country interpret Israel and Palestine, which also feeds their ideas for the best solution in the future, we go back to 1948. And it's incredible to see, even in the left in America, and not only in America, that for many years, probably unintentionally, people were ignoring 1948 as the beginning of the story, or as a pivotal moment in the story. Anyone who worked endlessly and religiously for a two-state solution, and I was there myself, I will have to admit, in my youth, was ignoring the importance of the 1948 and the Nakba for the history and present and future of Palestine. And even when you heard the Secretary General of the United Nations very bravely and courageously, and should be commended for it, when he said we should understand that the events of the 7th of October did not happen in a vacuum. And he immediately says, what I mean is that what happens on the 7th of October happened because of 56 years of occupation. No, my dear Secretary General. It happened because of 76 years of occupation, not 56 years.
You're listening to Ilan Pape on Myths of Israel. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To order copies, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
This kind of history that is not being told or is not being told properly is important because you have to talk about what happened in 1948 as an act of ethnic cleansing, as a crime against humanity. And you have to understand the connection, for instance, between what goes on in the Gaza Strip and the events of 1948. For instance, there was no Gaza Strip before the Nakba. The Nakba produced the Gaza Strip. Gaza was a cosmopolitical town on the Via Maris, the road from Alexandria to Alexandretta in Turkey, where a lot of people and goods and ideas were passing. It was organically connected to Jaffa in the north, to Beersheba in the east. And it was part of a district that included many villages and small towns. Now, in 1948, when the Zionist forces began to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, they pushed the Palestinians in the north to Lebanon and Syria, the Palestinians in the middle to Jordan, or what became the West Bank, and they wanted to push the Palestinians in the south to Egypt, to the Sinai Peninsula. But like today, Egypt then as well refused to allow Palestinian refugees to cross the border. So Israel had the young Israel, had a problem. So they decided to create this rectangle that you can see on the map as the Gaza Strip, as a huge refugee camp, as a receptor for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that they expelled during the second half of 1948 from the south of Palestine into Gaza, making the Gaza Strip the biggest refugee camp on earth. And the last wave of villages that were forcefully removed and its house burned and demolished were the villages that are today, on the ruins of these villages today, are the Jewish-Israeli settlements that were attacked by on the 7th of October. So you need to know that history for understanding what was going on also on the 7th of October and not just in the Gaza Strip itself. 70% of the people who live today in Gaza, 70% are 1948 refugees. And many of them are from villages and towns which are very near to the Strip itself. Not to mention the fact that the international indifference to the ethnic cleansing in 1948 provided encouragement to Israel to continue the ethnic cleansing in other means after 1948. Because after all, in 1948, Israel succeeded, in inverted comma, only to ethnically cleanse half of Palestine's population. And many of the refugees remained in Palestine itself, in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and refugee camps in the West Bank. And many others remained in refugee camps near Palestine. So in order to complete the incomplete ethnic cleansing of 1948, Israel continue ethnically cleansing Palestinians, first from inside Israel until 1967, and then after occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, not on the same magnitude as it expelled them during 1948, in a more incremental way, but nonetheless, hundreds of thousands, to my account, about 450,000 Palestinians were expelled from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip between 1967 until the 7th of October, 2023. What I see today is an Israeli decision to use another method in order to complete the ethnic cleansing of 1948, and that's the method of genocide. And the first phase of genocide finished in the Gaza Strip. We don't know the numbers. People are talking about 40,000. But what we hear from United Nations officials about the many bodies under the rubbles, we're probably talking about 200,000 people. And now Israel is moving into a genocidal operation in the West Bank under the pretext of another mythology, that they're actually preempting an Iranian proxy war against Israel. But this is just a pretext for beginning a genocidal policy toward the Palestinians in the West Bank, and I'm afraid that the next station after that are the Palestinian citizens of Israel. This is a messianic Zionist, or as Nur Masalha calls it rightly, a messianic neo-Zionist government that believes it has an historical opportunity to complete the total de-Arabization of Palestine from the river to the sea. And this opportunity will not repeat itself, and therefore, contrary to the way the American administration looks at the situation, are very much in favor of escalating the situation into a regional war, because like the Christian fundamentalists that believe that a huge explosion, violent explosion, a doomsday war, Armageddon kind of war, is part of the divine scheme that opens the way for a different kind of period in the future. And we should take seriously these notions and the way they are being translated into policies on the ground. I would like to finish by talking a little bit about the mythologies that are connected to the future. But I think that one of the major challenges we have in trying to spread the word or to inject a new, an old new kind of dictionary or vocabulary into the way we would like people to talk about Palestine, about the situation today and about our hopes for the future. And some of that language, I'm very happy to say, has been adopted also by the solidarity movement here, by the encampments. And when people ask me what is the difference between the solidarity movement with the Palestinians in the 70s and the one that emerged in the last 10 or 11 months, I say that I think that more clearly the necessary vocabulary is being now adopted and spoken naturally, if these kids were born with this kind of dictionary. And that's very encouraging to hear that. And that is a non-nonsense approach to Zionism as a colonialist project, jettisoning the conversation about peace, replacing it with conversation about decolonization, challenging the Israeli notion of being the only democracy in the Middle East by referring it to an apartheid state, settler colonial apartheid state, and by adopting a vision that is so beautifully, of course, encapsulated in the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. I think this is something that is still a far cry from the way mainstream media, mainstream academia, and mainstream politics are talking about Palestine, especially, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, all this conversation on the day after is based on the two-state solution. The idea is to create another Bantustan in the Gaza Strip, similar to the one in the West Bank, and somehow hope that this is going to work. God knows where did they find the source of inspiration to think that it should work, on what basis, what books are they reading, who are they consulting? I have no idea, because so much nonsense being written recently on this. But whatever it is, if we find a way of injecting this conversation with the right terminology, I think we are going to be able to defeat the mythology, both in our academic works, in our activism, in our conversation, and insist that this is the language we should use. We don't use conflict, we don't use peace, we don't use two-state. Two-state solution has been dead for so many years. It's lying in the morgue, everybody is afraid to have the funeral, but it's time to bring it into an honorary burial so that we can all have a closure and move on. And I'll finish. There was kind of a humorous moment in my conversation with the two agents in Detroit when they asked me, do I believe in the slogan that Palestine should be free from the river to the sea? I said to them that everywhere there's a land between two sources of water, people should be free. Yeah. But one of the guys wanted to show me that he did listen in his geography classes, and he said, what about Bulgaria? I remember he said. I said, okay, everywhere between any two sources of water, I'm sure there is, I haven't looked at the map, people should be free. I really believe that it's time that we will use the same language in our academic courses in universities, stop teaching Palestine in political science department that deal with conflict management and conflict resolution, move it to modules for decolonization, genocide studies, anti-colonialism, and let's defeat the oxymoron, academic courage. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sigil. I'm actually the co-chair of DSA International Committee's Palestine Subcommittee. And DSA is Democratic Socialists of America. We're kind of big tent. And I was curious, you mentioned that there was a time where you also believed in the two-state solution, or two-state delusion, as I like to call it. And we still have some comrades, I think, that believe in that. And so especially Jewish comrades, I'm wondering, how can we help have that conversation? If it's like, what was it for you as someone who grew up there, was Jewish, what was it that made it click for you and made you into, you know, such an uncompromising and staunch anti-Zionist?
As for the question of the two states, first of all, we have to admit that whoever represents the Palestinians today, whether it's the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian political parties inside Israel, they still subscribe to the two-state solution, which is one of the reasons, I think, some members some people who are part of the solidarity movement with the Palestinians would say, why should I adopt a position that those who represent the Palestinian Liberation Organization do not adopt? I'm not more pious than the Pope. And that's a difficult issue. But I do think that it's important to engage with people on the issue itself rather than on questions of who represents whom rightly or wrongly. And if one doesn't see the moral weakness or deficiencies of the two-state solution, namely an idea that relates only to 20% of Palestine, that relates only to half of the Palestinians, that has nothing in terms of solving the Palestinian refugee problem, that is keeping Zionism, be it in only 80% of Palestine, still keeps it, this racist ideology, intact. If that doesn't work, they only have to be 5 to 10 minutes in the West Bank, virtually or physically if they can, and to see that what Israel created in the West Bank is irreversible in terms of a two-state solution. I think it is reversible in a one-state solution. The fact that there are 700,000 Jews living in urban sprawls, not just isolated settlements. The natural growth is such that the number will double itself very soon. It's only if you want to apply transitional justice, which we would have to, through a process of decolonization to places, and not just the people who live in these places. This can only be done in a project that totally de-Zionizes and decolonizes Palestine, not in redeploying the Israeli army in such a way that creates these awful Bantustans that anyone living in the West Bank would tell you that life before Oslo was much better than life after Oslo. Thank you.
Hi, Ilan. I'm a rail worker from Toronto. I'm a big fan. Gaza in crisis was huge for radicalizing me, so thank you for that. I have a question about a narrative, maybe it's a myth, but this narrative is that models of class struggle and ideas of class struggle don't really apply to Palestine because everybody in historic Palestine, everyone from the river to the sea, is either too privileged to engage in class struggle because, you know, if you're an Israeli, you get free land and that sort of thing. You get free military aid from the U.S. So everyone's either too privileged or too oppressed. Like Gazans, of course, their industry keeps getting destroyed. Like you mentioned, it's like 82% of Gazans are refugees. Within the 48 borders, Palestinians are kept out of Israeli industry. And in the West Bank, one of the only jobs you can get is construction, building the settlements that are settling you out of existence. So this idea is that there's no real revolutionary subject or subject of class struggle because everyone either gets too much or is too oppressed to engage in class struggle. So I was wondering if you think that's a myth.
I'm from St. Louis. My Congresswoman Cori Bush was one of the first to call for ceasefire. She's been the most pro-Palestinian, one of the most pro-Palestinian congresspeople. So then AIPAC spent $15 million to beat her by, you know, 5% or so, and I'm sure you've heard about this, but to me shows like a sign of desperation to spend that much money and to pull out all sort of tricks just to win by that little amount. I wonder if this is kind of like a sign. I hear you say the beginning of the end of Zionism. If this is kind of a beginning of the end of it, just AIPAC having to go up that far out. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
What is the strategy we can use to push back so that these AIPAC campaigns to defeat Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush end up having payback so strong that we're going to actually end up helping to defeat and fight AIPAC? We have to make this cost. What are your recommendations?
First of all, about the class struggle in Palestine and the privileged Jewish society, I think it's a more nuanced situation. As a former member of the Israeli Communist Party, I know how we failed to create the coalition we always wanted between the Mizrahi Jews, who were the main component of the Jewish working class in Israel, and the Palestinians, who also were an important part, whether Palestinians from inside Israel or the occupied territories after 67. And it didn't work because of the way the most of the Mizrahi Jews were de-Arabized and under the influence of some of their rabbis became probably in large numbers the base for racist anti-Arab policies in Israel. However, I don't think this is an irreversible process. There are a minority, but they exist, of Mizrahi Jews, call them Arab Jews, inside Israel, who definitely can be recruited and be galvanized for a class struggle that will go along the Palestinian liberation struggle and not against the Palestinian liberation struggle. But I do think it's important to analyze correctly the situation of the Israeli economy right now. You have 20% of the Israelis paying 80% of the taxes. Many of them are leaving Israel. They already began to leave Israel before the 7th of October because of the rise of the neo-Zionist messianic political forces to power in November 2022. The economic situation is in crisis, and the gap between those who have and have not does not includes also the Jewish society. It's not just an ethnic demographic issue. It's a classical class issue, and it's not the only place in the world where the left finds it difficult sometimes to recruit the working class against xenophobic, racist policies that are connected in the West to immigration, in Palestine to the issue of the occupation and the colonization. So I think this is something that should not be looked at only as it stays today, but we should allow our imagination to go beyond that. After all, most of the Jews who came from Arab and Muslim countries don't have dual nationalities. They don't have European passports. But they will stay in Palestine after the collapse, and the collapse will come. And they are much closer to the area, its culture, its language, despite 76 years of human engineering that try to disconnect them from their own heritage, identity, and language. The question of the AIPAC success, I do agree, actually, with the second, I didn't write names of comrades, but the second question. I do agree. I think the might used on one candidate or so on is a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of strength. AIPAC is part of a larger I don't have to tell you this, you're here in America, of a larger pro-Israeli lobby. It doesn't include only AIPAC, but AIPAC is an important pillar in this structure. And it's a very veteran advocacy group. It exists more than 100 years. And like all such structures, which are so old, that is, their longevity, also exposes their weaknesses. And the biggest weakness of AIPAC is connected to our work in the left. What I mean by this is the following. If we believe that politics can only be defined the way it is defined by our political elites today, then AIPAC works on a viable model. Mm-hmm. Then it works on a viable model. This is politics. Money buys you victory. It's connected to capitalism. It has nothing to do with the agenda of the people itself. Politicians are there for power, for the sake of power, for their own fulfillment, and so on. But if we believe, and I think we all believe, that, and there were some good indications in France that this is possible, that there can be a redefinition of what politics is. How does politics, or how should politics, represent the agendas of people on ecology, on poverty, and so on? AIPAC doesn't have the tool to deal with such transformation. So because I believe the old kind of politics is not going to sustain for long in a world that faces global warming, poverty, diseases, and where people would have to rely back on human solidarity and intersectionality and all the things and the left had believed in, I think that AIPAC, like the State of Israel, is using force because anything else they would have liked to use, which is moral arguments, human arguments, is not working. It's very clear that you can bomb people with F-16, but not their ideas. And the epitome for this is the Israeli idea that they can wipe up the Hamas in Gaza with a genocide. The Hamas would survive. And unfortunately, a lot of people would pay the price, but the Hamas will survive the genocide of Gaza. It will remain there because political Islamic ideology is the one that seems to so many Palestinians right now as the only one that dares to resist the occupation and not collaborate with it. So it will remain a powerful, valid force as part of the Palestinian liberation movement. And the change in the civil society in the United States, the change in the American Jewish community, the change towards in the attitude towards the Palestinians in Israel cannot be stopped by money, political power, and all the other lethal methods that AIPAC has used over its 56 or 57 years of existence. And it is still effective because we have not yet changed the way politics is being done. But I do believe that this whole structure of politics, the way it is being done here and in the global north, is on very weak and precarious pillars that are shaking. It's like there's extensive cracks in the foundation of this building. Finally, no, there's no finally. I think that's more or less it. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
You were just listening to Ilan Pappe on Myths of Israel. Ilan Pappe has been called Israel's bravest historian. He's the author of many books, including 10 Myths of Israel. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Thomas Suarez, Michael Parenti, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And we have a series of programs on the Middle East. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Ilan Pappe, Myths of Israel, and for his classic book, 10 Myths About Israel, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Miles Davis, If I Could Write a Book.
at the various gatherings, the big gathering they had at Carnegie Hall for the 75th birthday of Paul Robeson, and you'll find the Harry Belafontes, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that gathering. One of the most powerful words were said by Coretta Scott King at that gathering. She was still mourning the death of Martin, and she said, "America did to Paul Robeson what I think they ended up doing to Martin. They buried him alive." See, Coretta's hitting on something deep. Inexcusable treatment of a person who had the courage to tell America about itself in regard to its injustices. They bury him alive.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is one of the 20th century's most enduring and multi-talented figures. He broke through the color line and excelled in sports, film, music, and theater. He became world famous, yet in the United States, he was to be persecuted and hounded for his political beliefs. In his recordings, particularly of spirituals and folk songs, Robeson's mellifluous bass baritone voice awakened African Americans to their heritage and gained him a broad audience. He won acclaim on Broadway, especially in the musical Showboat, in which he sang the classic Old Man River. His dramatic performance in Othello is legendary. By the 1930s, he was singing in major concert halls all over the United States and Europe. By the early 1940s, one biographer states that Robeson was the most famous black man in America. Theodore Dreiser, the well-known writer of the day, hailed Robeson as an artistic and social genius. Never content to be just an entertainer, Robeson had strong political views, and he wasn't afraid to express them. He condemned racism and segregation in the United States. He was an anti-imperialist who advocated the liberation of Africa and Asia from their European colonial masters. He was an early and vociferous opponent of fascism. He visited Spain and sang for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who were fighting Franco. He admired the Soviet Union and said so openly. After World War II, the U.S. was saturated in the ideology of anti-communism. The Soviet Union, erstwhile ally, was now the arch enemy. Robeson's support for the USSR did not waver, and for it, he paid a heavy personal and professional price. He was a target of Hoover's FBI. He was verbally and physically assaulted and attacked. One notorious incident